You are listening to Friends of Europe's podcast. Don't miss our debates on global and European issues that span political, economic, social, and environmental challenges, and follow our website at friendsofeurope.org.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for coming back from the networking lunch. I hope you've had good conversations and made some headway in synergies and cooperation for the future. This morning we talked about the changing global landscape and how EU CELAC could work together on many, many issues that are out there. There was a discussion also on connectivity. I thought that was really interesting. And now we're going on to the global commons. How and if EU and Latin America can actually work together on some very significant milestone events that are coming up in the next few months. Of course, there's the post-MDG, post-2015 Sustainable Development Agenda, very important negotiations coming up in September at the UN General Assembly. We've got the Financing for Development Conference in Addis in July. We've got also the global climate negotiations, very, very important in on the world stage. And of course, there is the ongoing Colombian peace process as well that we talked about this morning, and ways of combating also trafficking in drugs. So there are some very important questions out there where we really need to see global ententes and alliances and coalitions building up, but also to try and put all this rhetoric or the conversation we've had on common values, common ideas, common aspirations between EU and Latin America into practice. Can you walk the talk, basically? So I'm going to kick off by introducing our panelists. I'm surrounded by some very, very interesting young men. Really nice privilege to have that. I'm going to start now with the extreme left, Petrus Ustups, senior expert at the Cabinet of the High Representative of the EU, Federica Mogherini. Thank you very much, Petrus, for coming over. Next to him, Peter Warheim, head of unit for climate finance and deforestation from DG CLIM, Climate Action European Commission. To my left, Roberto Dondas-Glowinski. He's DG for Global Issues, Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Mexico. And he's Mexico's lead negotiator on the UN climate talks. To my right, Daniel Luis Alvarez. He's got a very interesting title, Citizen Security Advisor at UNDP in Panama. And thank you also, Daniel, for being here. And last but not least, to talk about the drugs issues, the drug challenges facing the continent, Ernesto Cortes. He's the Executive Director of the Costa Rican Association for the Study and Intervention on Drugs in Costa Rica, as I said. Okay, so we're going to kick off. I'm going to make a plea now. Of course, I've asked our panelists to be short, snappy, and to the point. But I would also like you to, while they're speaking, come up with some interesting follow-up questions to put to them at the end of their interventions. I think it's very important that we have really an interactive discussion on some of these very crucial global challenges that we face. I'm going to kick off, actually, with you, Peteres. You know, there is a lot of talk about synergies on global issues. We're talking about convergence, how EU and Latin America can sort of work together in global fora to push the agenda forward. Can you give us an idea of how this is working and if it is really working?
Thank you very much, first of all, for the invitation to participate to this panel this afternoon. It's so difficult to be inside because this is one of the rare sunny days in Brussels, so the real climate change is there. So therefore, talking about the global challenges is probably a little bit more in the afternoon if the sun is outside. But as you said, the next 12 months will be extremely busy on different kind of global challenges for the international community. Therefore, from one side, let's say we see that four different or even more important topics are coming up on the global agenda, and then the question is either there is not too much on the agenda for 1 year, because international community should really agree on all of those issues in relatively short time. The good news is that the EU recognizes all those global challenges in its agenda. So we have climate change negotiations going on in the Council. It will be on the agenda next week during the EU CELAC summit, and I can come back on this. Drug policy, either internally within the EU or as the aspect of the coordination and cooperation with other partners, is there. Development agenda, sustainable development goals, all is there. No doubt that actually the same issues are on the agenda also of the CELAC. So from that perspective, we have a good news that we can't escape from those topics. We need to discuss them, and we need to agree on some common lines. Therefore, the sense of the partnership and potential is there. And I think this is one of the messages. I'm pretty sure that the figures I'm mentioning are not new, and probably they are already in the air here in the room for several times today, but EU and CELAC together makes one-third of the United Nations. And the agenda, what we are talking about, is basically UN agenda. Therefore, if one-third of the United Nations can agree on something, there will be enormously a lot of pressure, enormously a lot of energy behind it, how we can use it, how we can use it for good purpose. I'm very familiar with how the decisions are taken within the EU, and I know it is not always easy to agree between 28 within the single institution, within single network. It is a challenge for the EU to agree on the positions. And sometimes I have a feeling that the CELAC as such is so diverse that we don't see, not always, let's say, the unity of the CELAC to come along on different topics. So we have, let's say, important players, we have different groupings, we have regional organizations, and I see this potentially as a little bit of the challenge, either for climate change negotiations, either for drugs or post-2015 sustainable goals. But at the same time, I don't think that we should be discouraged. The diversity sometimes is also useful. Therefore, even if the opinions might be different and it might take a little bit longer time to agree on the common positions, we will arrive there. The other reason for talking to each other and trying to agree is the need for the constant attention in the partnership. You can't say that drug issue is an issue in the partnership just once in 5 years. We need to talk about it. We need to see each other. We need to raise those issues and see what kind of policies are developing and what is there. I think we later in the panel we will go more into details in specific topics, either climate change, either drugs or post-2015. But at the same time, I think we need to look in the longer term. Even if this year will be over with such a heavy international agenda, there might be other issues we need to start to think about as common topics between the two regions, which later on might become also the topics for international agenda, like, for instance, energy security, like water scarcity, like, for instance, cybersecurity, or pandemics. In one or the other ways, I think that the agenda is so rich that not only concentrating on the topics today, but also seeing some topics in the perspectives, our agenda will be very, very busy. Therefore, the ways how we are addressing and trying to agree on the common positions will be extremely, extremely important.
Thank you, Peter. So really a need for constant conversation, but I would, from my experience, say don't broaden the dialogue too much, because the EU has a tendency to have a laundry list of discussions when you go into conversations with external partners. So I think the idea of actually focusing on a couple, well, not a couple, but maybe five key issues is actually a good path to take. But thank you very much for setting the tone. And I think we'll talk about the potential being fully tapped in a minute or two. I'm going to turn now to Roberto. Mexico has actually done something that a number of other countries are still hesitating about, which is taking quite a proactive position on the climate talks. And you're currently, well, actually you're coming from Bonn and rushing back to Bonn, where you're talking about preparations for Paris. And you've done something which is, I have to, sorry, look at my notes for this, Intended National Determined Contribution, INDC. And my colleagues at Friends of Europe who deal with greening issues more intensely than I do say it's quite interesting and quite significant. Your turn.
Well, thank you very much. First of all, I would like to thank you for the invitation. It's a pleasure being here. And not only for that, but you put my mind at rest, because when I was looking at what this panel was going to be about, and I saw four topics. And these are four topics that look very diverse. The problem is that I have to deal with at least three of them directly. So they're not that diverse. Of course, there's the issue of Colombia, which put it outside, but the other ones, climate change, post-2015, and the world problem of drugs. For countries in Latin America, all of these issues are development problems and development issues. These are not security issues that we have to deal with. These are issues of development and impediment to development. And that's the way we see it in Mexico. That's the way we are focusing in our foreign policy and working with these issues. So actually, they fall out pretty well. And so let me start with what you asked, which is the climate change talks and what Mexico is thinking. There's no bigger threat to the society as we know it right now than climate change. There's no bigger threat because it's so complicated, and so it's one of those, you know, things that happens bit by bit. And you might not want to realize it because the medicine that you need is quite harsh. So you say, well, you know, I get used to it bit by bit. Yeah. And suddenly we're going to get to a point that it's not reversible. So we're still at a point that we can work and make it reversible. And that's what this negotiation is all about. And that's why it's so important to get an agreement in Paris. The reality is that the problem that we face with climate change, and many have claimed, you know, maybe the best way to deal with it is to get the major economies of the world together and to see how we can mitigate the amount of gases that we emit. And we actually do that because there's one thing that's called the MEF, the Major Economy Forum. And we get together and we talk and we look at actions. And for instance, Mexico and the U.S., we just announced and we create a bilateral task force on climate change. We're going to be working very strongly with them, especially in the border region where there's a lot of things that we can do together. We cannot do it apart. But the reality is that we need everybody to be involved, not only the major emitters, but also those who are the most vulnerable to climate change. Mexico, we emit around 1.4% of worldwide gases. That's not too much. But we are a growing economy, so probably those gases are going to increase. Nevertheless, we don't see ourselves getting nowhere close to the tons per capita that Europe emits or the U.S. emits. But we took it very seriously. This has been something that we have taken very seriously for a long time. And having the COP16 in Mexico actually helped to create the environment that allowed us to pass our national climate change law. And our national climate change law is very strict about what we need to do. So, and I don't foresee an agreement in Paris which is stricter than what we're doing internally. But the way we are building Paris is about each country. First of all, this is the way we start. Each country is going to say what it is about to do, what it can afford to do, how it's going to do. So Mexico came out with RI indices. We were not only the first developing country to present, but we were the first major economy to present by ourselves. The EU had presented, but as a group, not individual, which is very different. So we, and therefore it was a bit of a difficult thing to do because we didn't know how to do it. Now people are, there are some examples out there. Mm-hmm. To go really fast, Mexico is proposing that by 2030, we're going to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 22%, starting from a 2013 period. Plus, we're going to reduce 51% of our short-lived climate pollutants, which is basically black carbon, and therefore we're going to reach an overall 24% of reduction of mitigation on climate change gases. For those of you who have no idea what I'm talking about, the most important thing that we're that we presented is, and this is for a country that is still a developing country, and we foresee important growth in the next few years. Plus, remember, we are an oil-producing country. Nevertheless, we announced that by 2026, there's going to be a decoupling between growth and emissions. So by 2026, although our economy should be still growing, our emissions are going to start to descend. And by 2050, this is also very important, we are aiming to full decarbonization. What does it mean? It means to have no more than 1.5 tons of carbon per person emitted in the country. So these are very strong targets, and we have a plan, and we believe we can achieve them. And these are unconditional. If we get assistance, international assistance, we can increase that 24% up to 40%. So this is what we're planning on doing.
Right. In fact, for all of you, Friends of Europe has published the details of your INDC. It has been published, so I encourage you to go online and check it out. Thank you very much indeed for that, Roberto. I do have some questions about how this may or may not be encouraging your CELAC partners, but let's do that a little later on. I want to turn now to Peter, who's also involved in the climate talks. When you hear what Roberto just said and when you see the broader landscape in Latin America in terms of emissions and reduction of emissions promises, what is your impression? Is it something that is going in the right direction?
First of all, thank you very much for inviting me also to this event. I have to admit that I was this morning at the European Development Days, which is going on parallel. We also had a discussion about the climate challenge, COP Paris, end of this year, which is linked to discussions on SDGs, on finance for development. Our colleagues are also sitting in New York, where finance for development is this week also negotiated. Mm-hmm. So indeed, it's a really full agenda this year. I mean, we only have one world. We need to tackle this climate challenge jointly, even though the consequences of climate change are not really to be felt here in this nice, very nice room. Obviously, there are regions in the world where the impacts are already very, very severe. What Roberto has explained and outlined is indeed very encouraging. We have a regular dialogue also between the EU and Mexico. I was myself in Mexico City in April, where we had a so-called climate policy dialogue, where we have a regular exchange about how we are trying to develop our domestic policies, how we see the international climate negotiations, the dialogue with Mexico is extremely constructive. And also, I mean, as a host of, indeed, as you said, COP16, you have made a very important contribution to international negotiations. What did it do? it basically took some of the, well, failures from Copenhagen. You might remember that Copenhagen, long time ago, was not so successful, but Mexico did a very good job in bringing together the international actors, industrialized countries, post-industrialized countries, developing countries. You took them at their hand, put them into an inclusive process, and this has enabled us to also come forward with important decisions already at COP16, which has ensured that we make progress. But nevertheless, we have to acknowledge that by today, since then, emissions have significantly increased. Therefore, the question is, of course, are these international processes successful or not? I would always say, yes, they are successful, because we are making progress in limiting in different countries around the world emissions, but we still have a lot of work ahead of us. And that's the same in Europe and in Latin America. In Latin America, Mexico is certainly a very good example of how an emerging economy also takes the climate challenge on. That was the same discussion this morning in the European Development Days. I would say addressing climate challenge and development are two sides of the same coin. That's increasingly recognized, of course, also within Latin America, the situation is extremely diverse. In terms of overall emissions, in fact, I would say Latin America and the EU have a similar share of about around about 10% in global emissions. The emission portfolio is very different. Also within Latin America, you have, of course, a lot of divergence. You have also the Amazon in Latin America. You have very significant forest resources which where a lot of progress is being made in reducing deforestation. Nevertheless, it's still a significant source of emissions. Brazil has made excellent progress in reducing deforestation rates with the soybean moratorium to stop the change of land use from forests to agriculture uses in some regions at least. There are a lot of renewable energy initiatives in Latin America on geothermal, on solar, wind power, hydro. In Chile, there's a lot of activity in that area. And at the same time, countries like Brazil, like Mexico, you are graduating. You are still calling yourself developing countries, but of course, income is growing, and the question indeed is how can that growth process, that development process be made sustainable? This is at the core of our discussion, but that's also at the core of the discussions in the Conference of the Parties. Let me maybe also mention this Conference of the Parties, which will come at the end of the year, COP21 in Paris. Within the climate community, everything is geared up towards this event end of the year. From European perspective, we hope that it will be that it will be an event which, of course, will have a successful outcome, but that it will also include more countries than under the last regime. We think the Kyoto Protocol was a good step forward. We have done our homework as a developed country. The European Union has taken on the commitments, the obligation which came from the Kyoto Protocol. We are very happy to see that countries like Mexico, like Gabon and other countries around the world come forward with this INDC, with this intended national determined contributions. But again, this can only be one step. We hope that it will, the various INDCs together by Paris will make a significant contribution towards keeping us below the 2 degree temperature increase. The more, the better. The more ambitious the outcome would be, the better. But nevertheless, this will not be the end of the process. It will, we will have to continue to meet regularly and follow up, because these intended national determined contributions have to become national determined contributions. They have to be translated into legislation. We are doing this inside the European Union. We are preparing also the review of our core elements of the climate policy. The heads of states last October only decided the cornerstones, that we want to increase our share of renewables to 27%, increase energy efficiency to 20%, and increase our greenhouse gas reduction target from 20 to 40% by 2030.
Right.
But a lot of work will have to come after Paris, action and implementation.
Absolutely. I just want to come back to Roberto. Thank you very much, Peter, for that. I just wanted to come back to Roberto on something that Peter did say, which was Mexico as a bridge builder. And I know that Mexico is part of this new grouping, making a few waves on the global landscape, MICTA. And all of these countries see themselves a little bit as bridge makers on the issue of climate. Are you sort of now sort of the leader of the emerging world and sort of trying to build, yeah, bridges between industrialized and emerging nations?
Yes, well, you see, Mexico, we are in the multilateral world. We are one of those countries that is a little bit everywhere because, you know, we are not, even though we are in the OECD, we are not a developed country. We are getting there, and that's what we hope to get to, right? That's what everybody's... But we are not there by any means. We have a lot of challenges, development challenges, huge development challenges still. But we are not G77. And therefore, we do play that role of bringing together, because we understand well the two sides. Mm-hmm. And we're not a threat to any of the sites. So that has actually helped us. I wouldn't, in climate change negotiations, whoever has been in a COP, has anybody of you been in a climate change COP? One person, I'm really sorry. I mean, these are, for those of you who want to know how, or who want, I think my students of, I teach conflict analysis in Mexico, you know, and when they ask me, how do you negotiate multilaterally, I tell them, please just don't try to learn in the climate change system. Learn somewhere else, because the system is very complicated, and it consists of negotiating by groups. In that grouping, you have the G77, you have the European Union, the umbrella group, which is the developed countries, which are not EU countries. And then you have the strongest of them all, of course, Environmental Integrity Group, which is Switzerland, Korea, Mexico, Monaco, and Liechtenstein. And it's the five countries that we don't fit anywhere else. But, you know, it actually works pretty well, because there are developing countries and developed countries in the same room. So we do play that bridging role. We played it also in post-2015. We played it, I have to say it because Danny here is here, so we played it in the Arms Trade Treaty negotiations as well. And right now we are facilitating one of the groups in the negotiations.
Thank you. So I'm going to turn to Daniel. Daniel, this concept of citizen security advisor, what exactly... It's on. Okay. Yeah. So what exactly is your task, and what do you see as the citizen security challenges that you have to deal with?
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity, and it's a very interesting and tricky question, because Latin America and the Caribbean, according to our last Human Development Report for the region on citizen security, is living in a very complex, in a very paradox moment, because if we analyze the last 10 years of Latin America and the Caribbean, for example, we have experienced a very important moment in terms of economic growth, in terms of democratic consolidation, understanding democratic consolidation as the regular electoral process. If we conduct in-depth analysis in terms of free of expression, free of association and others, there are some threats and some concerns remaining, but in terms of traditional democratic consolidation is a very historical moment. We even have reduced social and inequality gaps, in spite that Latin America and the Caribbean remains as the most unequal region in the world. But in terms of citizen security, the problems persist. And the cost and the impact of citizen insecurity is a very heavy impact in terms to reach a sustainable development for the region. We are talking that in Latin America and the Caribbean countries, we record around 100,000 homicides per year. The estimation that we have calculated in terms of the economic impact is 4.5 of the GDP for the region. So it's very heavy, and with a lot of differences between the Northern Triangle, for example, is much higher than in the Southern Cone. And this is the most visible side, the most visible part of the problem, because we have also a most invisible, like, for example, gender-based violence, that is one of the most serious crimes in the region.
Violence.
Gender violence, and most in terms of frequency, problems of corruption, problems of governance, problems of human rights in terms of limitations of the exercise of human rights caused by fear. So the impact is very, very heavy. And one of the reasons of this situation probably is for the lack of quality services in terms of security and justice. Mm-hmm. Or security and justice institutions in Latin America and Caribbean countries, in terms of public confidence, in public trust, represents the lowest levels. We are facing levels of impunity that are completely unacceptable, even for serious crimes like homicides. 98-99% of impunity of these crimes. This is, to me, the most serious cancer that Latin America and the Caribbean is facing in terms of citizen security. But in spite of this situation, there are some improvements. And this is something that Europe has to recognize, has to start to deal with. We have countries like, for example, Honduras, that has reduced in the last 2-3 years 20 points its homicide rates. So this is something important. And from Europe, I guess that we have to recognize that in the same way that Latin America and the Caribbean is one of the most violent regions in the world, has generated a very sophisticated policies, very sophisticated interventions to deal with these issues and these problems. One of the areas, for example, that Latin American countries are dealing with is the extension of the rule of law to the entire territory, to the entire population, for example. Because for many, many years, for many, many decades, we have countries like the favelas in Rio de Janeiro, like colonias in Central America, or even right now in Colombia, for example. We have 30% of the territory of Colombia that is not controlled by the state, is not controlled by the rule of law. They are not full citizens. And one of the challenges that we have to address is how the democratic institutions provide these services with high standards of quality to the entire population. And in talking on Colombia and in the peace talks, this is one of the challenges. The peace building will be not only addressed in Havana. The peace building process in Colombia has to be very territorial and has to address this kind of tasks. And this is something that from the European Union, for example, they have to improve and to understand, because this level of sophistication, for example, is very visual, is very clear in terms of the national authorities. But in terms of, for example, the regional processes of integration, we have some concerns, for example. Particularly in Central America with SICA and the Caribbean with CARICOM, the regional bodies, there is a huge gap between the national agendas and the autonomous bureaucracies of these regional bodies. And I guess, like the EU as one of the main partners of these regional bodies, one of the elements that we have to address is this process of sharing the experience of a real integration process to guarantee the regional policies on citizen security and access to justice for these countries. Another element is that the traditional cooperation that Latin America has received, not only from Europe but from other regions, in a very simplistic way, has been or technology for law enforcement or very naive prevention programs. And the problem of citizen security in Latin America is so complex that it's not enough. We have to sophisticate the way that we are doing cooperation in our countries and to understand that it's not a question of hard hand or soft hand. We need a small hand. We need a very much more sophisticated way to address the issues, to address money laundering, to address corruption, to address...
Sophisticated how, Daniel?
Sophisticated in the way, for example, to combat phenomena like money laundering, mm-hmm. to promote witness protection mechanisms, to improve the prosecution mechanism of the judiciary to generate evidence to incarcerate criminal, but also to rehabilitate the inmates and to have a more adequate models on justice and citizen security. And right now we have, as said before, an interesting international agenda. This General Assembly, we have to deal with the new Sustainable Development Goals. One of the goals that has to be considered by member states should include crime and violence as a potential new goal to monitor development. And the next year we have the global debate to review the drug policy, that it will be another important opportunity to improve this partnership between Latin America and Latin America and the Caribbean.
Thank you very much. That is indeed a very, very insightful comment. I just want to quickly turn to Piteris very quickly. When he talked about, Daniel talked about Europe's role, the need for a more sophisticated, more nuanced approach, does that sort of resonate with you?
Definitely, yes. It resonates because the EU, from our side, we monitored the situation already for quite a while. On related to the citizen security in Latin America in general and in Central America in particular. And acknowledging the problems of the citizen security, the EU adopted last year in July citizen security strategy for Central America as a concrete step to demonstrate that we see the problems and we want to engage. At the same time, as always with the EU strategies, this is not an instrument one-sided, meaning that actually it is just for the EU to do or propose. This is the way to reach out and to talk with the Central American states in order to agree on common actions. And it's not always easy to get, let's say, the support and interest from the governments. It's a little bit challenging. Next week, we will have the EU CELAC summit here in Brussels, and one of the documents just finalized this week as one of the deliverables for the summit is Action Plan, which is linked to the Citizen Security Strategy. Therefore, this is a commitment not only of the EU in terms of the actions and the financing, but it is also the commitment of the EU member states. And at the end of the EU CELAC summit, we will have, let's call, mini-summit with SICA, where actually this issue will be one of the concrete deliverables also reflected in our joint declaration. So I see the potential on working on this with Central America, but at the same time, as already said by colleagues, it's not a phenomenon of Central America. I see the potential of expanding, and we will move on to the drugs, where actually the issue should be probably even widened, because there is one departure point of the trafficking in different ways, and we should take into account also what happens, for instance, in Gulf of Guinea and the African routes, where actually several strategies of the EU are coming together. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
We can go into some more detail about that in a minute or two. No, Ernesto, Daniel talked about the need to put crime and violence firmly on the SDG agenda, and crime and violence, if I understand things correctly, is quite related to the drug trafficking problem across Latin America. And you are dealing specifically with that issue. So what do you see as the main sort of tasks and challenges ahead when you're trying to combat this scourge?
Thanks, Shara. Thanks, Conrada, and our esteemed Friends of Europe for this opportunity to be here. In fact, yes, we have a big issue in Latin America with drugs. We're a production region, cocaine in the south, well, marijuana everywhere, even opium, Mexico or Guatemala has been producers. And we're also traffickers. It's a transit country also. And the problem has grown more, has grown bigger, in fact, in the last decade, let's say. And we have even converted into consumer countries. As we know, Brazil is one of the biggest or the highest consumers of cocaine in the world. So, and this occurs in a moment or in a period where Latin America has been complying and developing all the strategies on the war on drugs. Strategies mainly coming from United States, the Plan Colombia, Plan Merida, Carasi, and in fact, all of these plans have been going on for the last 20, 30 years in our region. And what we see is that the problem is not diminishing. It's getting bigger. There's more trafficking, or it's spreading every other places. Now it's not only Colombia producing cocaine. You can see it in Bolivia. You can see it in Peru. The cocaine, let's say, in Central America, 5 or more years ago, you didn't see the amount of violence you see right now. And it's also because 90% of the cocaine that goes to United States goes through the Central American territory, ended in Mexico. In fact, even in Mexico, they are producing new psychoactive substances, methamphetamine, to distribute in the United States. And this has also made our countries to start thinking if the strategies that have been developed are effective. So even in the OAS, the Organization of American States, there has been a big discussion. There has been two declarations in Guatemala City and Antigua, and there were two reports published that I recommend everyone to read these reports, because they're really good and well made by specialists all over the world. And one of these reports even recommends several paths or several ways that the region should take regarding this problem. We also have Central America with countries with the highest rates of homicides in the world. And I'll you talk about that. This new approach also comes from three countries specifically, Mexico, Colombia, and Guatemala, that have been asking and have been looking forward for a global discussion. And in fact, this General Assembly special session of United Nations on drugs the next year on April 2016 has to do exactly with that, with the pressure that Latin American countries have put into the whole world, saying we are getting the most of the costs of this war on drugs, economic costs, human costs also, even environmental costs, if you can say. So the new perspective, or this new way of viewing or trying to approach drug issues, has been taking us obviously through a human rights perspective. at least from me, that I work in a civil society organization, when you say human rights, you have to see people. You have to change the view from the drug, the substance itself, or the markets, to the people. And the people most affected by these policies and these illegal markets are most vulnerable population. And what I'm talking about, it's drug users, farmers, cultivators, and low-level drug dealers. If we check in our jails, most of the people in jail in Costa Rica and the rest of Latin America are not big drug dealers or big cartels or big capos, are the small ones, are the ones that are dealing in the streets, are the ones that are transporting heroin in their belly, are the ones that are even using. There's still a lot of countries in Latin America that criminalize drug use. In all Central America, except for Costa Rica, if you get caught with 5 grams of marijuana, it's 30 days of jail. And the conditions that our prison system is right now, I don't think this would help anyone. So, European Union and European community have been helping Latin America for the last long time. But at least in the last 4 years, there has been a program, a cooperation program on drug policy, COPOLAD, that has been developing in several areas, mainly by regional dialogues, helping drug observatories so we can have research and we can have indicators and information to help us change these drug policies, and also have worked on supply, demand reduction, and demand reduction for sure. And it's important this because the issue, and I think what we should focus on what European Union can work, it's what all my colleagues here have said. It's a developing issue, a development issue. Drug policies don't only deal with drugs, deal with healthcare, deal with economic policy, deals with security, deal with migration, deal with environmental issues. Anyway, it deals with so many things that when we think how we can help this and how we can change, from what I think, it's going more to alternatives of development, to go on how we can reduce, I don't know, the proportionality of sentences. Many of the people that are in jail are in jail for 8 to 10 years. In many countries, drug dealing, it's a harsh felony, and it's treated even harder than homicides or violations. So there's a lot of experience that European countries have had, mainly on a healthcare, let's say harm reduction policies, that has been going on in Switzerland or in Netherlands for the last 20, 30 years, that in Latin America it's not even discussed. So, of course, we have to center, or we have to deal with drug trafficking, for sure, mainly big criminal organizations. But I think when we talk about security or drug supply, we should focus more on how to reduce violence and how to eliminate these big organizations. But we should focus more on how to work with this low-level drug traffickers or these development issues that would change, really, how the drug traffic or the drug problem is affecting our country. And all this, and I want to say, because I had a little bit of discussions here in the coffees and in lunch in the dinner yesterday, in a context where Uruguay is legalizing marijuana, for example, and several states in the United States are also doing, and it's not only for medical purposes, it's also for recreational purposes. So I think it's a context that gives us a lot to discuss, a lot to dialogue, a lot to share in a new context, because there's not much done.
Just a very, very quick follow-up. You mentioned three countries that were changing the narrative a little bit around this whole problem that you've rightly described as also a development issue. Just very quickly, how is that narrative evolved? What would the key points of this new approach?
A little bit, and maybe Roberto can fill it.
He's had a say.
All right.
No, I'll come back to you.
This narrative, it's different because it's changing the view from a supply reduction focused. If you see Plan Colombia or Plan Merida has always focused on how to stop drug from going south to north and how to put people in jail, how to articulate and even military training. And what these countries are saying is we have internal issues. We have problems in our countries that are really affecting us. And we've been doing this kind of strategies for the last 30 years, and it's not changing our problems. It's even getting worse. Mexico is the worst example on how drug policy had been doing. So I think it's a conservative way of view, but it's more a human rights approach, healthcare approach on reducing violence. That's the main issues, and how we can change the view and how we can finance more on a local point of view, how we can finance or help, let's say, civil society organizations that give treatment services to drug users, for example.
Okay. Thank you very much, gentlemen, for your very incisive and lucid interventions. Now, I'd like to have, as Giles always says, a show of hands to see, if I can, how many people are interested in coming in into this discussion. Right. Okay. I see three ladies. If we could start with Marcella over here, please.
Yes, hello. My name is Marcella Szymanski. Some of people in the panel know me from different guises, but I am here today as a Mexican academic. I was wondering this morning when they were talking about the new adapting to the new economical and social challenges and the new realities of globalization, etc., how much the topics that are being discussed now have become, particularly the one of drugs, have become just matter of factly. In such a way that I am going to look at it now from a point of view that is could be even considered cynical in Mexico, my country, and some other places. In October last year, David Cameron here was surprised in the European Council when he was told that the contribution of the UK had to be augmented to the rate of 2.1 billion euros, because now the new accountancy rules of the European Union demand that all revenues of the gross of the GDP, the gross domestic product, include the black economy, tax evasion, prostitution, and drug trafficking and consumption. This increased enormously the UK thought that was their income. It's been in force since last year in the European Union accountancy rules. Italy declares cocaine, prostitution, illegal drugs. Spain as well. Germany, some countries stand to win from these new accountancy rules. So I was wondering what those new accountancy rules would do to the figures of trade of the EU with Latin America, certainly with Mexico, if the revenue from drug trade, because we like to call it trafficking, but in many countries of the EU, consumption is legal. So let's call it trade and take it into the accounts. What do you think that this would do, and how much it would push or motivate another type of tone in the negotiations, especially when so many countries are saying, but we are a poor country, we are a developing country, and all of a sudden you add 2% or even more of your GDP. Thank you.
Thank you, Marcella. I think that's a very, very interesting question. Any one of you gentlemen, I'd like to... I thought that would be something that, Roberto, would like to take up now, and then we'll go...
Sure. But then I'm going to also take the opportunity to just go back to 2 points. One, Daniel was talking about the SDGs. That's goal 16 that talks about rule of law. That's the most important one. We have to learn from our past mistakes. Economic development, which doesn't create the kind of established institutional development that we need, it's something that can be swiped away at any moment. Nevertheless, not everyone in Latin America was okay with Goal 16. We all accepted it. but some countries were not very keen on it. But there was a very strong group of Latin American countries and who fought together with the EU to get Goal 16 in. So that's an example. And just to go to the drugs issue, what have we been doing, and why did we call Mexico, Guatemala, and Colombia for the ONGAS 2016? And by the way, let me tell you that many countries did not want it, including many European countries. Mm-hmm. Simply do not want to have a real debate at the UN about drugs, and still they don't. It has been fight after fight in the rooms to make sure that we have open debates, that civil society can go in, that can hear it. One of the biggest issues that we have is that drugs issues are normally dealt with in Vienna, which is great. The only problem is that many of the most affected countries in the world have no embassies in Vienna. So their voices are not heard. So all the Caribbean, because there's no one single Caribbean country with an embassy in Vienna, so their voices don't matter in the drugs issue. And that's why we said, you know what, it's time to have a debate in New York, where everyone is there. Nevertheless, and what is it that we're saying? You know, we learned from Europe. We learned, you got it right. In the 90s, when harm reduction idea started, it was about saying, wait a second, it's not about the drugs. It's about the problem the drugs create. Let's deal with the person. Let's help the person. I think that's absolutely right. The only problem is that if you only help the person in the consumer country, then the balance that we're supposed to have between how we address production and consumption disappears. And suddenly we have what some have claimed to say, you know, developed country or consuming countries are simply exporting or subcontracting the fight against drugs. So in my country, I'm very flexible, but I ask you to involve your military in order to deal with the offer. That doesn't work. Let's be very clear. It doesn't work. And you know what? If we all agree that a peasant's life in Latin America who doesn't have anything, you know, he needs food to put in his table, and then he might be cultivating marijuana. He's doing wrong by it, but nevertheless, if we all agree that his life is worth the same that the life of anybody who might be consuming or affected by the consumption of drugs in Brussels, then we can talk to each other. And then we take harm reduction into what we call preventing social damage. And we deal with the criminality in drugs because we have to deal with it. Let's not kid ourselves. But we do it in a way that we don't affect societies, that we prevent the social damage of societies, that we work on the social fabric, that we make sure that the small towns in Latin America are not displaced, that we make sure that people actually take care of their homes, their families, they see a future. That's why it's a development issue. So the point goes very much into that, the question. I don't know exactly about the numbers. It would be interesting. We would have to deduct the amount of money that goes out from our countries in order to illegally buy arms from the arms producers. So we would have to deduct that part. Yeah. But it's a, you know, but that's exactly the scores. We want to go to 2016 and have a debate. No, we don't want to change the international conventions on drugs, but we want to change the way we think about how to handle this problem.
Thank you.
I just want to...
Ernesto.
Thanks. Say a little bit. I think it's drug trade. Yes, indeed. But the difference is it's an illegal trade. So as it is illegal, there's no laws, there's no regulations. People don't work for a minimum salary. They don't have holidays. They don't have anything that helps them keep their jobs. And violence, it's the coin. It's dinero o plata, oh, ¿cómo es? The gun or the money. And that's how it's been working all so long. So what we want and what we need, and supporting what my colleague here said, it's to put the people first, to put the persons, the producers, the drug traffickers, the dealers, even the users. And that's how should the dialogue start, because it's just starting.
Thank you. I will take a few more questions and then come to the lady who's just stood up, please.
Yes, thank you. I had a question for Roberto with this perspective of changing the way we tackle the issue of violence and drugs in Central America and in Mexico. I'm Jimena Reyes from the International Federation for Human Rights. And in my organization, looking at the gravity of the crimes that are being committed in Mexico, homicides, forced disappearance, displacement, etc., and looking at the level of impunity, and also looking more into details about the structure of the crimes that are being committed, we believe there are international crimes that come within the competence of the ICC that are being committed in Mexico. So my question is, do you think the government, and maybe you can speak on your personal, because I know it's not your issue, but the government of Mexico could be interested in asking the International Criminal Court to investigate the situation of Mexico in order to judge high-level drug dealers and narco-traffickers and also, in some cases, maybe public forces that are involved with them. And I have a second very small question for Daniel. You said that the homicide rate in Honduras had gone down 20 points. That's a lot. Could you explain to us if there's any reason? And a very short comment on Colombia, because it was also one of the topics, and I think it's an important one. An hour ago at the Eurolat, there was a discussion that was supposed to be on the peace process in Colombia, and was invited to that discussion beside the ambassador of Colombia, Jessica Hoyos, the daughter of a trade unionist that was killed and who's also human rights defenders. The ambassador asked her not to ask the parliamentarians not to speak. It's a problem, but and it's very emblematic also of how to tackle this global challenge in Latin America, that is the polarization of society, of countries, and how you open up to really having mature democracy with pluralist parties. Thank you.
Thank you. That's a very important question. I'm sure our panelists will take great interest in responding to that. Thank you very much. I had a lady over there.
Thank you very much. I'm Julieta Gonzalez from ACT Alliance EU, an European network working also on Central America specifically. I have two concrete questions. Nobody mentioned the Alianza por la Prosperidad that is the northern countries of Central America signed last year with the United States. I would like to know what do you think about that document first, and then how, if you have taken it into account in the EU Citizen Security Strategy and Action Plan. And then the second one, if we understand well, one of the outcomes of the summit will be a chapter on citizen security between the two regions. I don't know if you could give us more information about that, what is going to be the content of it, and what can we expect from that. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Last chance for anyone else who wants to put a question at this stage, because once the panel has responded, I would like to bring the session to a close. So I see no urgent, desperate hands going up, which I guess is good news for the moderator. Okay, so should we start now with you, Piteris, and then do it linearly? So.
Thank you very much. Paying attention to the action plan and the citizen security strategy, the action plan will be adopted by the Council in coming days. Therefore, it will be a public document, and there will be a possibility to look into the actions already planned. But at the same time, it should be mentioned that we try to avoid to make the action plans as standstill documents, but rather living documents. And this is just the beginning. Those are actions we have at the moment, but the doors are open for the future conversations within the region, with the government, with different organizations active in the region on the security, on citizen security, in order to enlarge the scope of the activities. As concerns the final document of the EU CELAC summit, as we speak, the negotiations are continuing, and there will be different documents to be adopted, but there will be specific final document for mini-summit with SICA, where the citizen security, I do hope, will be making the reference in the final document. And of course, this is not the EU only document, but we are discussing it with the region, and we hope to finalize the document with the reference specifically to the citizen security there. Thank you.
Peteris, I just had one question that's been on my mind since you spoke in the beginning, actually. You know, we've talked about the diversity of Latin America. We've said there are so many regional organizations. You have bilateral arrangements with many countries. Is there a real sense and value added of having a continent-to-continent partnership exercise, region-to-region? Isn't it a bit too big to deal with?
I think there is a value added also in the diversity. And I think from the EU perspective, we need to pay attention to all relevant formats, starting with the smallest one, individual countries. Of course, we will not be able to develop only the relations at the continent to continent. Our basis will be the bilateral relations, whatever relations we will have. Either it will be trade, either it will be citizen security, either it will be investment, climate change. The basis will be individual states. At the same time, the EU is actively promoting regional cooperation. And regional cooperation, once I mention it, we have wide variety of the regional organizations in Latin America. We can talk about Caribbean, we can talk about Pacific Alliance, we can talk about UNASUR, we can talk about other organizations like SICA, and we are promoting it from the EU side because we see the value added from our own experience in the EU. What does it mean if there is more regional organizations? And once we reach that level, we see that actually some of the issues we might have better possibility to address between EU and regional organization. Mm-hmm. At the same time, once we move to the next level, definitely there are issues we need to discuss as continent to continent, as the EU towards Central America, as Latin America, all together, Caribbean. So yes, those issues we started with, like global agenda, they will go through each and every level. But it makes sense and probably bigger impact on the issues at the international agenda if we will take the note of them and if we will discuss them at the highest possible level between the two continents. Mm.
Thank you. Peter, does that apply also to your sector of specialization?
Yes. Clearly, regional cooperation is key in the climate change area, but even more so multilateral cooperation. I think we are doing both. In the CELAC summit, hopefully climate issues will also feature prominently. We have this coming weekend, we have also the G7 summit in Elmau in Germany. Hopefully the leaders will also make clear statements on what they will contribute to the COP21 agenda. There's G20 summit coming up in November. There are lots of regional cooperation forums in which we want to make sure that clear messages on a successful and ambitious, legally binding outcome of the Paris conference will be enshrined. But I also see another cross-cutting issue for all of the challenges we have discussed here. That is simply good governance making progress in establishing the rule of law and providing good policy signals through good policy. That is key in the climate area, and I guess in other areas as well. And it's also important to take the business community along. We have not talked a lot about the business community, but we have tried in Europe to also, with our climate policies, correct for market failures by establishing, for instance, the emission trading scheme. That's a key element which is important also around the world, that we give to the business community the right signals to get the investments good, to decarbonize. We don't have a lot of time. We have to hurry up.
Thank you very much, Peter. Roberto.
Well, thank you again for the invitation. It's very good to be here and talk to all of you. I think there's a lot of work and possibilities still for working. Let me just on the question on the ICC. No, the ICC doesn't apply to this. We have to understand how the international system is doing. Plus, let's also be very clear. When the major issue we're facing in the security field, it's an issue of criminal groups going at each other. We have to deal with that from the ground up, not from the top down. Otherwise, it doesn't work. We have to create that capacity. That's why the reforms are very important in order to do that. In those cases where government has been involved in some actions, the good thing that we're seeing is that people are in jail. That's what it's supposed to do. When there's a problem, you have to investigate, you have to put people in jail, and you have to repair the damage. That's what international law says, and that's what has to happen, and that's what's happening. Hopefully, we don't need to do that anymore. That's what we have to get to. But it takes time. It's very complicated, and we have to do it. And we have to do it all together, because the drugs issue is not an issue that's only for a single country. I mean, and moving from drugs, I think there's a lot of opportunities for Latin American countries and European countries and the EU to work together, as we have done very closely at the UN. We always work very, very closely, at least. And also in the drugs issue, I think that's an area where we haven't actually been able to work as closely as we should. Because I'm sure that what the 20 countries that came out with a joint statement from Latin America, Africa, and Asia on the logic of social damage prevention, that statement, I'm certain that can be also subscribed to by the EU countries. So hopefully we have to create that dialogue to make sure that we go together in this part as well. And of course, the fight that we're going to do together to have an ambitious agreement in Paris and to support the French presidency in its endeavors. Thank you very much for the invitation.
Thank you very much, Daniel.
Yes, thanks. On the reduction of homicides in Honduras, it's very difficult to say what has been worked. Probably one of the reasons is that it's much more easier to reduce when you have 86, an homicide rate of 86 to 66, than when in Costa Rica you have an homicide rate of 10 to 8. It's much more easier when you have more margin. But in any case, we wonder to think that some of the efforts of the government in terms of the depuration of the police, the depuration of the judiciary, have contributed to a more close oversight on the security and justice institutions, and that they are doing quite better their job. In any case, an homicide rate of 66 is nothing to celebrate, and we need to keep moving and keep pressing the government and the society of Honduras to improve the situation. On the Alliance for the Prosperity, this initiative of the U.S. government, the new development plan, is estimated around $1 billion per year for 5 years. It is a very ambitious plan. We are working very close with the U.S. government to define and to design this program. It's not still closed. It's on discussion and has to be approved by the Congress of the United States. But to us, it's a very important and interesting movement, because for us, the Americans have understood the situation of Central America, and they are changing the way of the relationship with Central America. They are moving in this smart hand strategy in terms of citizen security, improving the sophisticated way to do prevention. It's not only in terms of the naive initiatives, but also targeting the root cases of crime and insecurity, targeting the youth at risk, improving the job opportunities, improving the governance mechanisms, and improving the role of civil society in terms of the oversight to monitor the situation of citizen security. So it's, to me, is in terms of the general scope of the program, is going well, but it's not close. It's a discussion. It will be a very tough discussion because there are a lot of internal pressures. So let's see which will be the outcome of this discussion. But I want to have a very final word, because there is a very important threat that none of us have mentioned. And takes probably the three dimensions, the environmental, the drug policy, and for sure the citizen security, is illegal mining. Illegal mining is, to me, one of the most serious threats that Latin America and the Caribbean is facing right now. It's not more an emerging issue. It's a reality. We know that drug cartels, they are diversifying their activity to be more engaged with illegal mining, because it's much more, in terms of profits, it's much more valuable, it's much more clean in terms of money laundering, it's less violent than drug trafficking, so it's increasing in a very serious dimension, has terrible environmental considerations and impacts, and also in terms of social order and coexistence, have a lot of impacts, because most of the areas of exploration impacts on indigenous people's areas and has a lot of consequences. This is something that we need to look very carefully, because these are a very strong reality that we have to address.
Okay. Thank you again for this dialogue. I think it's really important, and I'm really happy that the drug issue, it's been dialogue, because it's one of the subjects that hasn't been part of many spaces. I just want to say, and get in deeper with the subject of violence, because if you see violence rates here in Europe, that's also one of the biggest drug consumers, are really low. So we are getting all the deaths. We are getting all the killings. What is happening that the drug produced and transported from Latin America to United States and to Europe, it's generating so much violence. And what gets here, it gets sold, it gets used, but not many people die. So there's security issues also, and how the police works, community police, prevention police, and all these strategies that at a local point of view can work. And can work very well. Also, accounting governance and corruptions, for sure, doesn't matter how much you try to teach a police on a community perspective if he receives funding from a drug cartel, for sure. But I think that's one of the issues that should be really important in a security program, for example. And for sure, trying to tackle drug routes, trying to tackle drug cartels and big organizations, and in fact that should be one of the areas, but also how to reduce violence, and in this case how to evaluate the progress, as the questions on how Honduras reduced or how Ciudad Juarez reduced, we don't know, because we're not even evaluating the programs. The indicators we use to evaluate is how much drugs we stopped. If it's a lot, okay, are we doing a good job or are we doing a bad job? So indicators or variables on how we develop our programs should be really important. And I think this indicator should be more focused on development issues and economic issues, social and healthcare issues, than in general, I don't know, security.
Thank you very much. I think that brings us nicely to the end of what's been a very, very interesting, multifaceted day. I think we've really quite well during the day prepared for the real EU-CELAC summit, but I would venture that ours is perhaps slightly more interesting than when 61 leaders meet 28 leaders and talk perhaps not enough informally, but I think there's a plan for a retreat, if I'm not mistaken, so maybe I'm wrong. I just wanted to say that it was really interesting to see how all the different topics we discussed are interconnected. I think you, all of you, went to the heart of the problem when you said, in the end, it's about development. And I think that is something that we really need to keep at the center of our discussions. You can't have any of the other, can't meet any of the other challenges unless you talk about it in the development sense. And I think what I really enjoyed about this session, thanks to all of you, is really talking about the everyday life of people when they're dealing with corruption, with drugs, with violence. And I think that is important to keep in mind, that it's not just on the global stage that we talk about these issues. They really are affecting millions of people. As you said, Daniel, also this issue of illegal mining, which I have to say wasn't on my radar screen. So thank you all the panelists for really very insightful contributions. I have to say thank you to my colleagues at Konrad Adenauer Stiftung for making this conversation possible, especially to Sabina, who's worked really hard with us on bringing some of you over and on making sure that we have an agenda which covers all the relevant issues. Thank you also to my colleagues at Friends of Europe who've worked very hard to make this a success. So please, thank you to all of you, by the way, also for listening and intervening and taking us in the right direction. So please join me in saying a big thank you to all these gentlemen who are here, five of them, who've really brought in some very real talk about Latin America today. Thank you.